get started, my name is John Wallace, and I'm on the teaching staff this summer. I first came to Holden when I was 15 years old, and so 1967, and I was here for more or less than 12 summers, off and on. And my grandmother, some of you who are old timers may remember Colonel Olson, who was my grandmother. She was the head of housekeeping, and so I would come up here when I was in high school and spend summers with her. And then when I turned 18, I had to work. I wanted to stay up here. So I left in 1977. I went to the University of Washington as a graduate student. I came back up one more time to Holden, and kind of in my life at that, you know, Holden was great for me. It was a tremendous shaping experience. That the fact that there was discussion and dialogue, you're thinking about things, and I always had, you know, sort of thought Village was a great place to come and recharge the batteries, and you got to go back out again. You got to go do stuff. And of course, I was graduating high school in 1970 in the middle of sort of people being socially responsible and trying to do things. And I really wanted to help save the world, you know how that goes. And I ended up working for the American Freedom from Hunger Foundation and doing some things like that. But in the end, I became an economist. I got a PhD in economics and the University of Washington. And then I went to Chicago for a couple of years as a postdoc. And in 1983, I moved to the University of Maryland. And I've kind of always struggled with this question of, you know, what am I doing with my life? Yeah. And it seemed to me if you want to help people who are poor, disadvantaged, as Patricia said this morning, you know, we're a people of stuff. You know, what about people who don't have so much stuff? And the problem, there's a real problem with economic development, and I'm going to talk about that all week this week. But I realized very early on in the process was that if I could possibly do something to raise per capita income in China by 1%, just one time, that would do more than Lutheran World Federation has done in its entirety. Okay? That in some sense, if we think about improving the lot of people, that what's happened over the last 200 years or 10,000 years, but particularly over the last 200 years, is very, very complicated in terms of the growth of the developed world, and that in terms of simply raising the well-being of people, and I'll talk about some measures here in a moment, that understanding how that process works is really, really important. And we don't have a good handle on it yet, because it only started happening 200 years ago. And you know, many of us think it's terrible. You know, we have too much stuff. We're running out of oil. We're doing all these kind of things, and I'm very sympathetic to those kind of ideas. But I think lower infant mortality and longer lifespans and better health and all that stuff is really good too. I always have an interesting thing about people here at Holden who've come to Holden to change the world and have a small carbon footprint. But they flew here, and all their food comes up on the boat and the bus. You know, the carbon footprint is an elephant footprint. You know, how do we do that? How do we think about that? How do we think about how society works? If we want to change it, we got to understand how it works first. Okay, and so I've done a variety of things. I wrote a book. and those of you who have been here in the past have heard about this book, and I want to read from the acknowledgments. Several universities and institutions afforded us with the opportunity to share our work through seminars, and we value the feedback we received at Brown University, Holden Village, dot, dot, dot. Okay? And when the end, this is Cambridge University Press, available on Amazon for $24, just in case you got $24. And they said, what's this Holden Village place? You know, you go there, you give seminars? I said, no, I go there and talk to people. And one of the things you need to know about me is that I'm not a teacher. Okay, I don't teach stuff. What I am, I have a publish or perish job at the University of Maryland. So if I don't write stuff, they fire me. Well, actually, I have tenure, so they won't fire me anymore. But they would have at the beginning. And so my job is not, teaching is wonderful, and I like to do it, of sort of, here's the stuff we know, and let me teach you about it. You know, stuff that you need to know that we already have figured out. My job is to figure stuff out. And so every lecture is, what's John thinking about today? Every class is what's, you know, And so I teach economic history, and I tell my students, this, the way I'm going to teach is I'm just going to stand up here and do it. Okay? So I'm going to think about it. So what we're, I'm going to talk about this week is a continuation of what I've talked about for the last three summers, and which was tremendously shaped by the discussions that I had with everyone here at Holden. Not only in hearing ideas from people, but hearing how you heard what I said. Those of you who write or speak know that very often what's going on up here and what comes out of here, it isn't what goes in to Marsha's ear. You know, learning that process is really important. And so I'm thanking you. One of my authors is 88 years old, co-authors on this book. And we're writing another book, supposedly. But we're thinking about it. Yep.
What's the name of your book?
Violence and Social Orders.
Violence.
Violence.
Not violence.
Do you have an example of what you're saying?
And social order.
Violet. Yes.
Violets was my home gardening book.
Okay.
That one. Like I said, what comes out here doesn't always go in there. And I'm going to talk about some of the ideas about this later on in the week. What I really want to talk about this week, however, as I said, I have this 88-year-old co-author. He's really interesting, and he was actually my undergraduate honors advisor, so I've known him since 1975. And so I've known him for 34 years. And you don't really need to know these details, but I had a colonoscopy. I'm 57, you know, so I put it off 7 years. Right? I'm 56, you know, so it's too late, you know, my wife was really bugging me. And the title of the talk I'm going to give today is called A Feeling of What Happens. Oh, shoot! Sometimes I'm so funny I don't even know what I'm saying. That's not the colonoscopy thing. Okay, this is the book I'm going to talk about by a man named Antonio Damasio, and I'll write it on the board. But it's a fantastic book, and it's one of the best books I've read in the last 5 or 6 years. But the book that follows it is called Looking for Spinoza. And the previous book to it was called Descartes' Error. I think, therefore I am. Right? So Damasio says, you know, that's not right. It's not just I think, therefore I am. And I'm going to talk about this in a little bit. Damasio is a neuroscientist who's about how does the brain work and about how do people make decisions. And what he says is feelings and emotions condition rationality. They condition the way we make choices. So we want to understand really how people make choices. We have to understand feelings and emotions. And my co-author, Doug, who had written a book about beliefs. And he said, you know, in order to understand how the world works, we need to understand what people believe. In a world of 6 billion people, do you know how many theories of how the world works there are? 6 billion.
And one.
Okay? Because all of you have a theory about how the world works. Every single one of you. You have a theory about when dinner is. Okay? And you've got theories about all kinds of things. If you want water, you turn on the faucet, right? Does it always work? No. It doesn't, right? Yeah, so you have beliefs about lots of things that aren't true, right? But nonetheless, they work. Yeah, so if we really want to understand how societies work, we need to understand how people think and how people form ideas and how they make decisions about how their behavior is going to be. In fact, economics is famous for assuming that people are
rational.
That is, they always make the best decision with the information at hand. We all know that we're not. So Doug said, you know, we got to think about what people believe, and it turned out to be a terribly complicated thing. And so this book has very little about beliefs because we couldn't make it work. And so I was trying to decide whether or not to push ahead with this next project with Doug. And so I picked, you know what happens when you have a colonoscopy, right? Now, some of you do, and some of you will know, is that you have to clean your system out. It's not a wonderful experience. But you just have to sit next to the bathroom for like 6 hours, and then you have to wake up at 3 a.m. and do it again, then you have to wake up at 7 and go to the guy. And so I started reading this book. And I recommend this book, but I recommend The Feeling of What Happens more. Basically, what Damasio talks about here is that in order to understand emotions, which frame all the decisions we make, we need to understand that our makeup as animals, if you will, right, is based around a system in which our body has feelings, hunger, pain, that we feel.
Duh.
But we also, as very complicated animals, have managed to evolve over millions of years an ability for ourselves to use those feelings to help us make decisions about the world we live in. And the way that that manifests itself is in emotions. And we all have emotions. So Damasio defines feelings as the things that we can't see, right? The things that are going on. We can feel them, but we all feel them uniquely. But emotions are the things that are visible, and we all know how to read other people, right? There are some people who can't do that, and they're handicapped, the inability to sense emotions in others. And so mostly what I want to talk about over today and a little bit tomorrow will be how this works. And I don't know what I'm talking about in the sense that this is work that I've done. I'm going to talk to you about what I've learned from other people. But if we want to build a theory of how society works, the first building block has got to be, how do people make choices? How do people behave? Even if we think that they don't have any choice. You ever said that? I didn't have any choice. Of course you did. You chose not to have any other choice. And so we want to understand how individuals behave. And I was challenged this morning by Patricia. I don't have an answer to the challenge yet. Matthew 13:44. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which sometimes someone found and hid. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Or the next one. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. These are actually two very different parables. In the first one, the guy finds the treasure and buries it in a field that he doesn't own. Rational? Well, yeah, I don't know. Treasure, right? God buries treasure in the field that he redeems. Right? Why is there all this talk about treasure? Anybody got any ideas?
There are certain things that we value very highly, and they're very important to us.
That's right. And what determines how we behave?
What's important
to us? That is, what people value determines what's in their interest. I can do some economics about that, but it would be trivially simple. A lot of this talk about treasure is, what do people value? What is your treasure? Because that determines how you behave. So the assumption that people are rational in economics is actually much more innocuous than most people think it is, because economists have no idea what people value. But they assume that they pursue their values in a consistent way. That's basically all that economists ever really assume. That we want to understand why people are making the choices they are making. And over again, right, we come to this, what do you value? The Bible study for this morning in the first story we read from Mark, that I had a page in, but I don't have any more. What's the 10?
10:17.
Oh, I do have a mark in it. It's too small. Now a man comes up to Jesus and kneels before him and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says to him, "Oh, you should
Why do you call me good? No one but God is good alone. You know the commandments. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not defraud. Honor your father and mother. And then the man said to Jesus, Teacher, I've kept all these since my youth. Jesus looked at him, loved him, and said, You lack one thing. Go, sell what you own and give money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. When he, the man, heard this, he was shocked and went away grieving, for he had many possessions. Now, those of you who are here this morning, we talked about, what does this mean? Oh, this guy's got too much stuff. I want to give it up. You know, if he had the right values, he'd say, oh, yeah, no problem. I'll sell it. I'll follow you. Okay, problem. Okay. What comes before the values in this story? Rules. Right? Did you follow the rules? Yeah. Sorry, it's not enough. Treasures are the things that we value that shape our behavior. We live, however, in a world, and I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail on this in just a second. We live in a world in which we participate in organizations. Not just groups, organizations. And organizations sometimes have rules. Last week I was not here, but I heard a great phrase. It was Michael Pellin. Pellet was doing the Bible studies. Talked about how the gospel, under the gospel law, is deactivated. You know, we don't need those rules. You ever thought, oh, if everybody was a Christian, we wouldn't need any rules. Those commandments, we just would what? They would be deactivated. You know, they would be there, but nobody would violate them, so they wouldn't really matter. How do we, you know, why is it that for more than 30 of us to gather together, we need rules? In some way. We need some way to do that. Okay? And that's actually the heart of what this book is about. Social order. How we establish that. And I want to talk about, you know, when I think about how societies work, about not just emotions and relationships that we have between each other, because we can sense each other's emotions, so we can build a relationship in which we can know what people's looks mean. My wife is really pissed. I screwed up that time. Okay? My son's here. You know, he's got a whole vocabulary of my looks. Right? What do they mean? Okay? We all have that if we know each other. But how do we get, you know, sometimes we don't react, we don't interact that way. We interact through rules. We hope we don't interact through rules, but we do. David's going to talk tonight about the, you know, what's
the LCA section always do.
Right. Which turns out to have some very rule-based implications, or there's a discussion about it. Who was here? Did the Bible studies last year? Tom, Brand. What? No. The next week.
From Bradley Schmeling.
Bradley Schmeling was here last year, and he's been struck off the clergy roster. And my cousin Tom was a lawyer in Fargo, and Tom was on the jury for the church. They made the decision that the rules of the church require that Bradley be struck off the clergy roster. And they also said, this is a really stupid rule, and the church should rethink this, right? But hey, it's the rule. Don't believe the church doesn't have rules. It does. It's got to. All large organizations have rules. How is society organized? How do societies work? We need to understand about rules. Mel this morning was talking about Vatican II, and one of the things I really liked was the pastoral constitution. Is part of Vatican II, what the Catholics wrote, and they said, hey, we got to be rethinking what we're doing. We need to think about the rules, about how we behave. For a variety of reasons, we like to think about rules as being out there. You know, they constrain us in some sort of way. But it's very difficult to understand how rules in a society work and how they... how they're sustained. Still rules in the state of Maryland about sweeping up your horse droppings. It's an old rule. and if you violate it, chances are you won't go to jail. But isn't the fact that it's a rule mean that you have to obey it? No. You can go to jail. You know, I mean, rules are not physical laws. And some rules just don't get obeyed. So why have a rule that doesn't get obeyed? Why do some rules work and other rules not? Rules, as to us as individuals, come down from on high, you know, unless we get elected to Congress or something. In which case, we make the rule. But if you think about it, we live with the rules, so we take them as things that are outside of us. But in fact, rules are, in any society, must emerge as an outcome that the society can either support or not support. Rules are part of our life, just as much as relationships are. And if we want to understand how societies have changed over time, we need to understand something about how rules work. And we need to know very clearly that rules cannot arbitrarily be imposed on any society. Because you impose the wrong rules, it won't work. So that if we want to understand how societies work, we need to understand the process by which rules emerge that in fact can function. And a lot of what we see in the modern world are societies that have rules that I will call impersonal. What do we mean in America by a rule that's impersonal? The Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal except for so slaves and women and people who are in jail and people under 18 or under 21 maybe, or people whose marbles aren't all there. You know, actually, not everybody is created equal, but the rule says, you know, supposedly. Now, when the government passes a law that applies one way to some people and another way to other people, is that an impersonal law? No, it's an impersonal law. The King of England had all kinds of laws that just applied to him. In fact, the law applies differently to different people. Do we ever think that way in America? Do the laws apply to me the same way they apply to Bill Gates? He has these lawyers, you know? All this money. We'd like an impersonal society in which everybody is treated the same. That's impersonality. If we're going to treat everybody the same, then we cannot take into account any aspects of their personhood. We've got to treat everybody the same. Now, if I put up two words on the board, which I will if I can find an eraser, quality and personality. If we're going to have a warm fuzziness award, which word do you like better? How many people like equality better? How many people like your personality better? Okay, so we're going to have this vote again on Friday. See where we're at. Okay, what does equality mean? Equality is really complicated. Partly it means treating everybody the same. Does it mean everybody is the same? God didn't make us that way, right? We know that.
Right.
Yes, we know that.
Should we all be the same?
No.
Hard question to answer about equality and the various dimensions of equality. And so what I want to argue, or we'll try to talk about, is that one of the things that really changes 200 years ago is the emergence of societies that are able to deal with people impersonally. And that is a really, really good thing. Does that mean that we should treat each other impersonally? No. Impersonality is not about the feeling of what happens. It's about how societies work. Societies that work personally have lots of problems. I'll try to give you a reason for why that is as we go through the week this week. But this is really this is what my life is about. My wife's really happy about it. You know, yo, here it goes again. is understanding how societies function, and then understanding in particular how modern societies have emerged over the last couple hundred years that promote economic growth, but political development, and all that sort of thing. Now, as I said, this is just what I'm, so if you have any questions at any time, I know that I'm very confusing. And I understand that oftentimes what I say doesn't make a lot of sense, so but you do this, say, you know what, I don't get that, because I promise you it's because I said it poorly or I don't understand it. Okay? You know this business, I had a really fun conversation with a woman I really liked, one of my wife's cousins, who said, oh, it's really nice because you encourage people to ask questions. You know, no question is dumb. And I really feel that way. Okay? I won't entertain any question. But let me tell you, you want to learn? You want to learn?
Yes. Yeah.
Then you got to have the balls to stand up and say, I didn't get that, will you say it again? Because if you didn't get it, you're going to say, we're all equally not stupid. You know what I mean? You gotta say, hey, you know, will you say that again? I just didn't get it. The king may not have a stitch of clothing on. And I'll say, maybe. Okay? Anyway, that's it. I'm gonna say this now and then I'll forget it. Because I'll talk. Yeah, Peter.
Just the Sotomayor here, yeah. Recently, where the discussion was law and the interpretation of law. But who she is as an individual, whether she should or should not take into account her own background.
Yeah.
In terms of judicial review, responses in court, it seems like you're touching on that in a sense.
You bet.
In terms of impersonality.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. Is our country shaped by law?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah? Is it shaped by personality?
Yes.
Yes. You're all very strong about that. How do the two fit together? Oh, that's a really complicated question, right? Every single person we elect to a powerful office, what's the thing we want to know most about them? What their policies are? No. What kind of person are they? Okay. John McCain changed his stripes last summer. Cost him the election, probably. Maybe not. I don't know. Right? If Sotomayor gets up and says, this is who I am, I promise you that I will enforce the law in an unbiased manner. Does it matter who she is? It matters to us, even if she does enforce the law in an unbiased manner. Even if a conservative and liberal justice would enforce the law in exactly the same way, although we know that there's all these gray areas they're going to be asked to decide upon. But it really matters to us who their character is, who they are. Why? Because we don't establish personal relationships with laws. We have relationships with people. Because people have emotions, and we are set up to be emotion reading machines. And some people are. Some people are not trustworthy. You know that, right? You got people in your life you don't trust, sometimes with good reason, sometimes not. Does that shape how you deal with them? You betcha. How do we fit that? How, that's exactly the kind of thing I want to talk about. How relationships, which have a strong basis in emotion, fit with laws, which have a strong basis in contract and in personality. How do we see those two things working together? And how do we understand how those two things work? And how does that help us understand why the world we live in has changed? Okay, so I got three cold hard facts. And I will not compromise on any of these. Really? Humans have been around for a long time. Cold hard fact number one. Until 10,000 years ago, roughly 10,000 years ago, 8,000 BCE, the dates we were getting this morning from Patricia, no groups bigger than 1,000 people. In fact, probably the modal size group, the typical human society was 30 people, hunting and gathering kind of bands. We know this from archaeological evidence. The first place that we know of, this is really strange, because if you follow archaeology at all, they have imprints of where people, you know, spend a summer in a cave and, you know, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of evidence out there about what happened. Settlehewitt, which is a city on the Anatolian Plateau, is the first place that's bigger than like 30 people. Guess how many people lived in it? 8,000. From zero to 8,000 in boop, boop, a blink of an eye. Okay, it's not a missing, so far there's not a missing link. Another place is Jericho, right? The walls are really thick and they're still there. Okay, we know it was a real place. Boom. Okay, so that sometime around 10,000 years ago, groups were probably 30 people. And in, beginning about 10,000 years ago in some places, initially in Mesopotamia, later in the Nile River Valley in Egypt, in the Indus River Valley, and other places in India, and in China, then later on in Mesoamerica, and in South America, what are called pristine civilizations arose, were large groups, and actually these groups got pretty big pretty fast. Tens or hundreds of thousands of people living in organizations, and they appeared quickly. Second.
I have a question.
Yep.
Why did they appear quickly?
That takes too long to answer quickly. What's this about? This is about organization, right? Clearly, large groups of people couldn't organize themselves until 10,000 years ago. And the evidence is there weren't any. And something changed in the nature of organization. There could be some, well, no, that's point three. This is a really short time period in biological terms. It's about, 500 generations? I mean, a mutation can happen that quickly. But people's minds might have changed, right? The way they think about the world might have changed, but it wasn't physical. I mean, there were clearly changes that were going on over the last couple hundred thousand years that produced modern human beings, Homo sapiens sapiens, very wise humans. When does they appear in the record about modern humans somewhere between 70 and 100,000 years ago, depending on whose evidence you believe. And there's not much evidence of rapid genetic change before that. And this is just too short a time period, and it's way too short to explain what happened 200 years ago. Which we typically call the Industrial Revolution. Although, how industrial is America? Not very. You know, if we want to manufacture stuff, we send it to China. Okay, so we might call this the modern developed revolution. All the places in the world today that are developed, that have high per capita incomes in economic terms, are also politically developed. They have some sort of participatory democracy, or if there are places like Hong Kong and Singapore are getting them, struggling with them. Or South Korea 50 years ago was a military dictatorship. Now it's a democracy. It's a kind of funny democracy. It's not an American democracy. Of course, it turns out America just has one kind of democracy. It doesn't have the modal or the, democracy. But they're all politically developed. Guess what? They're all socially developed. They have religious freedom to a large extent. Not always. There's a lot of mixes there, right? There's a whole host of things that happened 200 years ago that are so dramatic that these certainly can't be explained by genetic change because they can't happen that fast. If we look at the world history, these are called hockey stick graphs. And they all kind of look the same. So here's time, and here's X, whatever it is that we're measuring. If we look at the population of the world, it looks like this. For a really long time, it's really small. And then it gets a little bit bigger, and then it goes like this. This is 10,000 years ago. This is 200 years ago. Okay? Now, we have to make some guesses about these numbers, but it's actually pretty easy to do it because if something doubles, if you put your money in the bank at a 1% interest rate and compounded, it doubles every 75 years, roughly. So that means in 150 years it quadruples, in 300 years it increases by a factor of 16. So 1% population growth actually over any substantial period of time will produce this enormous exponential growth And if populations have been growing at 1%, Adam and Eve would be about here. Okay, so we know that population had to essentially not be growing. We know that incomes had to not be growing for very much, because if it takes, depending on how we think about it, $500 a year to live at a very low level, that if income had been growing at 1% per year for a very long time, people would have been all starving, not very far back. But if we mapped out life expectancy, it would kind of look like this. Yeah.
Is this the third cold hard fact?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
So this?
1,200 and now population.
Well, you know, I really shouldn't say that. I will say that. What I've just showed you is a cold hard fact. The third cold hard fact I wanted you to get, though, is no genetic change.
Okay.
So that what happened? There it is. Oh, it came back. This graph is essentially a way of depicting fact one and fact two. Okay?
Okay.
That 10,000 years ago something happened, and 200 years ago something happened.
Okay.
Now, we're still living in the middle of this revolution. When did it start? Well, many people think it started in, we talked about this morning in mail session, 1517. Luther nails the theses to the door at Wittenberg, and the world was never the same again. Very famous book called by a German sociologist named Max Weber, Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. Now, it turns out who's the hero or the anti-hero in that one. It turns out to be Calvin, not Luther. But it's still that somehow that we changed the way people thought about the world. That the Protestant Reformation has a fundamental way of changing the way we think about the world. Now, you heard it from Mel this morning. Luther was a Catholic. Okay? Luther did not believe that the Catholic Church was wrong about God. He believed the Catholic Church was wrong about how society was organized. Right? Everything that Luther is complaining about is not about God. It's about how the church is organized and how the church manifests itself as a group on earth, as the body of Christ. Now, Calvin and Luther would split over, not Calvin and Luther, the Calvinists and the Lutherans would split over how do we organize our life. As much as theological debates about the age of baptism or stuff like that, it was, you know, should we have crosses and churches and paintings? Should we sing? Should we dance? Should we drink? Should we do whatever? When you look at all these Protestants, you go, you know, man, the Catholics and the Lutherans aren't very far apart, and the Protestants are even closer. Why are they so separate? Because they all believe different things about how they should lead their life, and particularly about how they should be organized. God, we got figured out. Well, maybe not. Right? But these things are about how we're organized. And so these are the kinds of questions that I want to think about and talk about this week. I have some time left, amazingly. Usually I plan my first 10 minutes and it takes the whole time. Now it just took 40 minutes. But I want to get back to Damasio then. I had this great, you know how you have, it's not like the road to Damascus or anything. But you, Patricia said it this morning, who said it? Maybe Dorothy might have said it last night. You know, you have this moment where you know you've learned something. You guys have those moments? Yeah. Oh, of course, that was, I pooped, but I have a friend, one of my other co-authors, Barry Weingast, and we were driving to the University of California at Berkeley to give a seminar about, actually it was not about this book, it was about a paper we were writing. We crossed the Oakland Bay Bridge, and we're in Barry's car, and he says, oh, I want you to see this place, I want you to see this place. And he points to a spot on the Oakland Bay Bridge. He says, that's where I got my only speeding ticket.
That's where
he got his only speeding ticket of his entire life. He's as old as me. I'm 57, he's 56, he's born September 1st is his birthday. And my immediate thought was, you don't drive fast enough.
Yep.
It's the only ticket he's ever gotten. My wife and I share tickets, you know. One gets one, I get one, we go back and forth. We are particularly prone to speeding cameras. So I have this persistent problem with getting speeding tickets. But what I realized about Barry, he's a very, very smart guy, is that somehow when he's driving along in the car and the numbers, the black and white numbers by the side of the road change, the way he feels about driving changes. You know, have you ever, how many of you have driven a car? Okay? Now, how many of you consciously think about everything you do when you're driving a car? None of you, because you wouldn't be in this room if you did. You would be dead, or in jail, for manslaughter, for having caused a fatal accident. If you drive a car consciously and rationally, you can't, right? Because it's just too complicated. You got to drive it by feel. So how many of you ever thought that you were driving too fast? None of you. Many of you. My son Dexter, he's gotten enough tickets that he rationally drives 65. Okay? And he'll tell you that when he comes home from college. Right? All of us, when we're driving, feel things going on. Right? Have you ever been nearly in an accident? It's a really emotional experience. Right? I mean, all kinds of things start happening to you. Is any of that conscious? No. Can you shut it off? You can't. And if you didn't have those emotions and those feelings, we couldn't drive. Now, there is nothing genetic about this ability that's tied to driving automobiles, right? Because we did not evolve to drive automobiles. But this ability to feel things is very important. And what Antonio Damasio, feeling of what happens as a neuroscientist, he was at the University of Iowa, he's now at the University of Southern California, talked about, or did his research on, he was researching decision-making processes. How do people decide? How do people make choices? I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, too. There's a field of economics called behavioral economics, which you may have heard about. A popular book out there is called Nudge, or the Malcolm Gladwell has one called Blink. All about how to, and the one I'll talk about tomorrow is predictably irrational, about how people actually make decisions. We're getting to learn a lot about that. Damasio's book was about how do people make decisions, and he started out with this guy named, the story of a man named Phineas Gage. He was a railroad worker in the 1880s, was working construction on a rail line, and they were setting dynamite charges. And when you set dynamite charges, you're supposed to use a broom handle so you don't make sparks. And for some reason, Phineas was using a metal bar. The dynamite went off, and this metal bar went through his chin, out the top of his head. And it didn't stick in his head. It went clear through. And, of course, he wasn't doing very well for a while there. But he didn't die. And he recovered consciousness. And he was, you know, ostensibly the same person. You could talk to him, you know. And he was like Dr. Spock, live long and prosper. He was very rational. You could ask him to balance his checkbook. You could ask him to do math problems. He was completely rational. He could make decisions. He could do logical deductions. And this guy screwed up every relationship he was ever part of. And if you ask him how much money should you set aside for retirement, you go, huh? It turned out that even though he kept all his rational facilities, he could make decisions, he could not frame decisions. He could not make good decisions. And he had no affect. He wouldn't smile or laugh. He didn't get jokes. You know, he didn't respond to people personally, so his personal relationships just kind of fell apart. Perfectly logical, emotionally crippled, and couldn't make good decisions, which we typically put in the category of rational. Right? So Damasio worried then about what is rationality grounded in? And as I said, the first book that he wrote about this was called Descartes' Error. The second book feeling of what happens. That if we think about even a simple single cell organism that's out there in the world, you know, not going to Holden or anything like that, this functioning, the organism has to have some way to react to the world around it, both chemically and physically. So as organisms begin to get bigger, they need to develop what de Maizière would call homeostatic devices. A homeostatic device in your house is your thermostat, right? It's something that automatically, when the temperature gets warm, it shuts the furnace off, and the temperature gets cold, it turns the furnace on. We all have homeostatic devices in us. The autonomic nerve system, which is sometimes identified with the reptilian brain, the base of your brain. Okay. We have all kinds of mechanisms in us that operate automatically. If you try to regulate your breathing consciously, eventually you'll pass out, unless you're the Dalai Lama and do this thing. We can't regulate most of our bodily functions consciously. In fact, we're not even aware that they're going on. And so the ability to regulate chemical and physical interactions was an integral part of organisms getting bigger. So this is not just part of humans. All animals have homeostatic circuitry in their nerves, okay? in their nervous system. Consciousness. What did Descartes say about consciousness? I think, therefore, I am. Right? That somehow the notion of human consciousness was based in our rationality, our ability to reason out problems. Those Jesuits that Mel was talking about today, or a bunch of Catholics, were really, you know, logic choppers. They didn't have to be Jesuits either. You know, Thomas Aquinas, these people trying to figure out, why are we here? What's God? What's the proof of God? Can we prove God exists? I think the answer is no, but I'm not going to say that really loudly. We feel that God exists. We know it, but proving it's a different thing with logic. That we have, in fact, all of us, all organisms have this feeling process, which is the circuitry that runs our thermostats. There has to be some communication between the physical state of our body and whatever is serving as the central control unit, whether it's a conscious mind or not. But if you think about the problem, as you get warm, you move into the shade, you get, you know, as your world gets more complicated responses, primitive consciousness occurs when you're aware of the feeling and the action. That is, your mind, even though we could be talking about a snail, okay, becomes aware that something has changed internally because of the feeling and has an appropriate response to it. And core consciousness or higher consciousness emerges when you remember that yesterday the sun came up and you got hot and moved into the shade. You look up and say, you know, the sun's about to come over the mountains. Why don't we just get in the shade now? Okay? Now, that's rational. That's forward-looking. It involves memory. And it's something that's triggered by a feeling. That is, we know that we need to get into the shade, not because we've read a medical textbook, right? That you don't have to know that heat prostration occurs to want to get in the shade. You feel it. You do it. Now, the marvelous thing about this process, there's lots of marvelous things about it, is that we learn how to do this. There is no gene imprinting for the numbers 55 causing you to feel you're going too fast if you're going 80. There can't be. Right? You had to learn to feel that you're driving too fast when the speed limit changes. You had to learn how fast it is to operate a car. A friend of mine who's a statistician says the optimal rate of insurance for a boy under 25 is the value of the car. Okay. Why? Because they haven't learned any of those feelings yet, right? And in fact, one of the ones is wee, bam. Okay. So If we drive by feel, and we don't have genetic imprinting to tell us how to feel, nonetheless, we know that as we get better at driving, it's not because we're better rational, it's because we are more experienced. And by more experience, we mean our emotional state in terms of driving a car has gotten more sophisticated. Our emotions learn. Our feelings change. About 4 years ago, I was at my sister's on Whidbey Island, and I love to cook. I learned how to cook at Holden in the dining hall, and the boys and I were there. We played golf that afternoon. We were going back home, and I cut the end of my thumb off, you know, just lob a little bit, and I was like, whoa! And my sister says, "Is everything okay?" And I said, "No!" You know, the blood was going all over. And, you know, I went to the hospital in Coopville, and they stitched my thumb back on, and they stitched it through the nails. And I'll tell you, for about a year, every time I looked at a knife, I got this strong feeling. Was there anything I could do up here to shut that down? Absolutely nothing. Even though I knew right away, I knew how to cut an onion. Believe me, I have taught several hundred staffers in the kitchen how to cut an onion at Holden Village. Okay? So, I could do it in my sleep, and believe me, I will never cut an onion in my sleep again. Now, DiMaggio says, and I'll just gonna have one quote. This is a beautiful book, and I encourage you all to read it. It's not simple. It's not... that is extremely well written. One might wonder about the relevance of discussing the biological role of the emotions in a text devoted to the matter of consciousness. The relevance should become clear now. Emotions automatically provide organisms with survival-oriented behaviors. In organisms equipped to sense emotions, that is, to have feelings, emotions also have an impact on the mind, as they occur in the here and now. But in organisms equipped with consciousness, that is capable of knowing that they have feelings, another level of regulation is reached. Consciousness allows feelings to be known and thus promotes the impact of emotion internally, allows emotions to permeate the thought process through the agency of feeling. Eventually, consciousness allows any object, the object in quotes, emotion, and any other object, or the object emotion, I'm not explaining that well. Maybe he didn't write it so well. That is, we can have emotion becomes an object in our life. It becomes a thing, as well as a response to things. And in doing so, enhances the organism's ability to respond adaptively, mindful of the needs of the organism in question. Emotion is devoted to an organism's survival, and so is consciousness. That is, the fact that we have emotions is not a trivial sidelight to the fact that we're rational. We have emotions because we're complicated organisms. And the emotions are how we feel what's happening. Now, sometimes those emotions are about things that are happening inside of us, and sometimes those emotions are about things that are happening outside of us. But we've all had experiences where some external event has caused us to feel intensely. Intensely sad, intensely angry, intensely happy. Our emotions are not the thing. They are our response to the thing. But they become a thing. How many of you have got your emotions all under control? Not me. My sons are here. I'm crying during Vespers every night. You know, I just like, wah! I have the, you know, we all have them, right? This stuff's going on inside of us all the time. Now, what DiMaggio says, and I'm going to talk in more detail about tomorrow, is that when we make a rational decision, that is when we take into account all the costs and benefits of our action and try to decide what the best option for us is. We have choices to make, and we have to put what on each one of those choices that we talked about?
Values.
Okay. We have to decide whether we like chocolate or vanilla when we go to the snack bar. How do we decide that? We don't decide that.
We have both.
What?
We have both.
We have both. I think that's one of those seven sins. We look over there. We have both if we're indifferent, right? In other words, we have feelings, we have emotions, we have values that we place on things. We have treasures. And you know that sometimes you cannot explain where those treasures came from. I feel it. I want that. That's important to me. That means something to me. I lose that, I'm going to feel a great deal of pain. The process of creating treasures in our life is not the outcome of a rational decision-making process. It's the result of our lives. And our emotions are ways that we learn, as well as things that come out of the ether sphere or out of our genetic makeup. So any theory of how society works has to start with how people behave. And any theory about how people behave, it's got to take into account the fact that when people frame decisions, they don't make decisions in a cold, rational manner. Even if they did only make decisions rationally, every decision they make is going to be framed by their emotions. What do they value? What do they like and not like? Peter?
I'm trying to apply the idea of emotions and decisions in a poverty environment.
In a what?
In a poverty environment, when societal influences are preventing them from making decisions based upon income, based upon social status. I guess I'm not sure where rationality fits in when you're being influence in that way.
Yeah, okay, so I'm going to fly away as an economist here. Don't ever say that society prevents people from making decisions. Everybody makes decisions. Some people are poor, which means they have fewer opportunities or choices to make. Okay? Have you ever, the Washington Post had this great article about a guy on he lived in a double wide in West Virginia. It actually goes to Frostburg State, which is up near West Virginia. So in Maryland, West Virginia is kind of this, you know, it's a boogie place where you threaten your children with sending them there. And he lived in a double wide, and his wife lived in a double wide, and they were divorced because they got more welfare money. Okay? Now, look, I'm not going to go here. This is not a criticism of them. And there was a doctor in Nigeria who was a Kenya, who was a well-respected man. And their incomes were the same. The physical control of the resources they had were the same. Okay, the range of choice about the physical goods and services, about the society that they could do were the same. Okay, now, widely divergent outcomes and circumstances. Okay. Choices are made. People who have fewer choices are in general poorer, but not always poorer in terms of money. You know, people who life is so much in a rut that they can't make anything but the same decision over and over and over again. Do you think of them as rich, even if they have lots of money? You know people who always, no matter what happens, seem to have 200 options to choose from? They're rich. I wish I was one of those people. Okay, I don't know.
Your choices are crime or dropping out of school. I mean, those are choices, but what kind of treasures are those, I suppose?
I don't know. I do know that people have choices. And how societies, the range of choices that are available to people has systematically changed over the last 200 years in the developed world. the range of choices for people is way wider. Okay. Are poor people faced with no choice? No, absolutely not. Okay, and I'm not trying to over emotionally respond. For us to say that poor people have no choice is, in some sense, I don't want to say that. They have choices. Is it easier? No. It's harder, right? Would you be better if you had a rich dad? Yep. Is it better if your mother loves you? Yes. No matter whether you're rich or poor in monetary terms, right? Is it better if you grow up with lots of friends who are intellectually engaging and nice? Yep. Is it than growing up with a bunch of friends who are criminal malefactors? All those things are true. And all those things are choices. Okay? I think seriously we should think about how society's resources are distributed and that sort of thing. But I don't think we want to say that they don't have a choice. They do have choices. Now the problem is that they may not make choices that get them where we would be. We might want to make different choices, and we are extremely good at saying these are the values you should have. We Christians are very good at that, right? We American Christians are willing to invade people and kill them to say, we think you should have some other options. Problem there, I mean, it's a tricky one. How does societies work? Yes?
At some point, society or medicine or whoever, though, labels choices neither rational nor emotional, but pathological, right? And I overspend, I don't know if I just do, or I overeat, or I don't.
Yeah.
So that sort of becomes not a choice, but a pathology? Or,
my wife feels that I'm dangerously overweight, and that it's a choice. She thinks it's a pathology. As well, and we debate how to perceive that. Okay? Our society frames the opportunities that we have is a product of how we all together behave, and it's very clear that a behavior 20 years ago that was regarded as perfectly normal can now be regarded as totally abysmal. How many of you used to smoke? Right? And don't now. Right? Because how we collectively feel about it. What is good to do and what is not good to do really depends sometimes on what people around you are doing. If you want to drive on the left side of the road, should you come to the United States? No, that turns out to be something that's really important that everybody do the same. So there are all kinds of reasons why collective behavior will influence how we feel about things and whether we feel it's normal or abnormal or right or wrong. And those things are continuously changing. Part of that we call culture. You know, have any of you ever been a teenage girl? I never was, and I don't understand how it works, but there were rules there that I just didn't get. But they all, you know, and one of them was to be mean to your mom, you know, and argue with her, and just, but love her too, you know. I don't understand any of that stuff. I don't get it at all, but it happens, right? And our society is really complicated like that.
Back to what he was saying, how does ignorance and then the economy, how it affects the ignorant that don't know that they have these choices.
That's a good question, right? How do societies decide?
What are
capable?
Our responsibilities in that?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. In terms of what we're responsible for, what I do know is that going back to the cold hard fact part. Is over the last 200 years, societies have managed to change. Some societies have managed to change a lot, sort of the scope of ignorance and the things that we do know and don't know, and making resources available to people to learn. Does that mean everybody takes advantage of them? No. And does that mean we all agree on what we should be making available? No. Okay. And that'll be part of but that then becomes part of the dynamics of how we act as a society. And I really want you, to, every time you.
I don't mean to pick on Peter, but Peter and I flipped pancakes 4 years ago, so I could do this. Every time that you think that society makes you do something, stop. The society is us. But it's us in a more complicated way than our individual life. It doesn't just mirror, society is not an organism that mirrors what we do. It's a complicated kind of thing. And so answering some of these questions requires us to think more deeply about how, in fact, societies make decisions about what we're collectively going to do. Okay? And I mean, I'm trying to...
Oh.
Yeah. Yep. But two more questions, and then I think we're out of time.
How do choices become spiritual issues?
Some choices... How, I don't know. How is it that some choices really matter to you and you feel you feel that the very essence of who you are hangs on that choice? You know, how is that? I don't know. Do you ever face one of those decisions? I feel like I really got to decide here. I go this way or that way. I don't know. No. We're asked constantly to do that in the Village Center. I'll confess, I believe. That can become a habit, but it's also a choice. I think how those things matter. This I'm not in any sense trying here to say that this is not a really important part of who we are. I think it really is. The problem is that some of what we feel is not subject to choice in a direct way. Because we can't change the way we feel by saying, I want to feel a different way. So we face choices about who we are. And this is what Spinoza wrote about. Was that if we pay attention to how our bodies and our minds actually work, that we can change ourselves by a disciplined application of choice. That we can teach ourselves to be better people and Christians. Those are deeply spiritual problems. Yep.
In this framework, would ethics be an emotion that an individual or a society would have based upon treasures such as greater good? Or how? Where would ethics...
You know, I never should write books about everything. Because then you can't say, oh, that doesn't matter. Money. Ethics comes in. Is Mel here? No, he's not. I wish he was here because I would defer to him, the intellectual historian. Okay, what are ethics? Ethics is complicated because ethics are in part a logical system of thought, right? So we can put a couple of philosophers in a room with some assumptions, and they'll come out with an ethical system that may or may not have anything to do with emotions. There's lots of ethical systems out there that don't work. You should behave this way, right? And they don't. They're logical, right? None of this says there's not rationality. We have a whole part of our brain. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. We have a whole part of our brain out there that actually says, how do I balance my checkbook? Right? How do I make decisions? How much should I invest? It works better in some of us than others. Mine doesn't work so well. We have a capacity for rationality. And in fact, a great deal of theology, ethics, that sort of thing, is about what? It's about rational thinking.
Isn't it also about what we treasure?
Yeah. that's why ethics is a complicated problem. Should ethics be the logical, what is logically the best way to live your life? What were the Greeks always writing about? The way of the good life? So we can apply logic to think about how we should live. Or is ethics, I should live the way that feels the best. You know, we can see problems with both of those approaches, right? So as humans, we have this combination of rationality and emotions. And every time we think about a rational problem, it's never a completely abstract problem. And everybody's, it may be in a book, maybe in Plato or Aristotle or Charles Taylor or somebody like that.
But in our real life, hey, I feel all this stuff. And how do we, you know, how do we, so I don't know the answer completely. I think those are combinations of things. I'm sorry, we have to stop. But we don't have to stop talking about this. I'll be around, you know. I'm going to talk tomorrow about some of this stuff with respect to what economists call behavioral economics, which is how people make decisions irrationally. There's what we can see about persistent behavior and things that make it, and how that allows us to begin to see how organizations might emerge. That is, how larger societies, how people interact in groups, and then how we might begin to think about how larger groups could form. Thanks a lot.